This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula.
So I want to ask a question. How many people here think that there's a good chance we're going to be able to make a smooth transition to a more ecological way of life? And I'll come back and ask the poll again, but just so you know your choices. And how many people think there's going to be some kind of major discontinuity, major disruption?
When Yes Magazine co-founder Sarah Van Gelder polled the 250 attendees at the Economics of Happiness Conference held recently at Fort Worden on the question of whether they thought the transition to a sustainable economy would be rough or smooth, only one hand went up for smooth. Everyone else expected a pretty rough road ahead. Which is probably the reason they were all there for the weekend-long event that brought together some of the world's most prominent thinkers, writers, and activists in the sustainability and localization movements to discuss, discover, and devise better systems for now and the future, as the event's website put it. The conference was organized by local activists, including Karen Wyeth and Local 2020 co-founder Judith Alexander, with major support from Swedish visionary Helena Norberg-Hodges' organization Local Futures, which has hosted a number of other Economics of Happiness conferences around the world, including in the U.S., India, Australia, Italy, and South Korea. Along with Van Gelder, Yes Magazine's co-founder David Corton, and Post Carbon Institute's senior fellow Richard Heinberg, Norberg-Hodge anchored the keynote panel on the first evening of the conference. This week on The Compass, we bring you highlights of that keynote panel. So now, let's go inside The Compass.
Mankuei Aten Sanaa, it is good that you are here. My name is Yutsia, my Indian given name, but my English name is Lonnie Greninger, and I am a citizen of the Jamestown Tsklallam tribe. And Port Townsend is actually part of our traditional territory of the Tsklallam nations. We share it with the Port Gamble Tsklallam tribe, and we also have our piece as Jamestown, and then our lower Elwha Tsklallam tribe in Port Angeles. So I want to be here to help welcome you to this beautiful area that I like to call home. And as a portion of our culture, when we welcome our guests to our land, we like to sing a welcome song. And the words in this song are to just show you that we are glad that you're here and we give you best wishes while you're here in this territory and while you're here for your event. So yes, welcome, my friends. So as I hold my hands up, that's a sign of thanks. So whenever you see the Port Gambles, the Jamestowns, or the Lower Elwhas hold up our hands, that means thank you in our culture. As a tribal citizen, I'm glad to be partnered with so many amazing organizations here in our local area. I was looking at your flyer here, and I love the top phrase here. It says, be a part of a world-changing conversation. Join with leading thinkers and activists from locally and around the world to explore strategies for effective action. I just love how empowering that is. When you come together as a people with the same ideas, we give each other power. And that's part of tribal culture. We're a people that are interdependent. We come together and we give each other power, and then we go out and we spread our wonderful ideas, and they become contagious around the entire world. You guys are doing amazing things here, and so I'm very glad that you're here, and you're going to be learning so much, and then you're going to take your ideas, and you're going to send them across the nations. That's how we can be world changers, like your flyer says. We take things out into the world. We as tribes, Indian people, we really appreciate our non-native partners, especially with climate change. We feel the effects of that. We know the water temperatures are rising. We see the migration patterns of our salmon are changing, and we're directly affected by the mercury that we find in our salmon now. We get only little serving sizes a day. That's really sad. It can be depressing. But when we come here and we have the encouraging work and empowering each other, I know that we can grow it to have healthy salmon once again when we're working together. When we work locally and then into the state and then we keep knocking on the door of the federal government for partnership, these are the world-changing experiences that we get to hold on to and spread throughout. So thank you, my friends. Mankuai Atin Sana, it is good that you're here, and enjoy the rest of your conference. Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Sarah Van Gelder. I'm one of the founders of Yes Magazine. I just wrote a book called The Revolution Where You Live. And I'm in the process of founding a new organization called People's Hub, which I'll be talking about some more tomorrow night. But what I want to do right now is introduce this extraordinary panel that we have to open today's conference. But I just want to say these are three folks that I have admired for many years. Each one of them is brilliant. Each is also, as you'll see, somewhat opinionated. And so in addition to allowing each of them to hold forth for about 10 minutes each, we're also going to have a conversation among them and see where there are differences and where there are similarities. So without further ado, do you want to start, Helena?
Okay, I will. I want to start by thanking Lonnie. Wonderful to have that warm greeting from someone who's truly native to this country. The fact that she stressed the need we must come together and collaborate to make change was really important. We believe that actually to make the changes we need to make, we need international collaboration as well and an international perspective. Our film, The Economics of Happiness, lays out the picture that we've been trying to get out for now more than 40 years, which is that as we see it, the world is moving in two opposite directions simultaneously. We have, unfortunately, an elite in big business and in national government that are pushing an outdated, completely destructive economic model. It's a model that started with genocide, that started with slavery and colonialism. And at its inception, it was very overtly racist and benefiting a tiny elite, the big wealthy landowners that then became the big global traders. And unfortunately, the fundamentals of that system have not changed. There has been a way that we've ended up subsidizing global monopolies, be they banks or fossil fuel companies or big pharma and big farm agribusinesses, the Monsantos, the Arthur Daniel Midlands. And it's happening across the board, left and right politicians. Also in Scandinavia, where I come from Sweden, our governments have, particularly in the last 30 years, very overtly ended up supporting a global economic agenda that supports the global players. But in our work, which started at the grassroots in a place called Ladakh, which is the westernmost part of Tibet, and in this part of Tibet, people had not been colonized and in the modern era not developed, because this part of Tibet was sealed off from the outside world. It's a part of Tibet that belongs politically to India. And then suddenly in the mid-70s, they decided to throw it open to outside visitors. It was actually in order to show that Ladakh belonged to India rather than China, because the border is disputed between central Tibet and west Tibet, which is Ladakh. And I was asked to go out as part of a film team. I was a linguist. I was living in Paris. And I had learned quite a lot of languages, had seen a lot of the world, and had a very different worldview from what happened after I was exposed to this, a part of the world that had not been colonized and where people had been allowed to develop and evolve in their own way, according to their own values, using their own resources for their own needs. So I come there in the mid-70s and discover people who are so much wealthier than anything I had ever thought would be possible without modern development, without industry, and all the things that we have been taught. Well, so what I found first, I was only going to be there for 6 weeks to help with this film, but I absolutely fell in love with these people. I had never encountered people who radiated a deeper sense of self-esteem and a type of vitality, a sense of humor, a sparkle. And I became so enchanted by these people, I gave up my job in Paris and decided to work on the language. I was helping to write down the spoken language, which was an ancient form of Tibetan. Learning to speak the language fluently also meant that I gained a lot of insight into how the modern system operates to destroy self-esteem, to destroy self-respect in the young, and through that, entering and dividing and conquering cultures worldwide. I've ended up working in Ladakh over the last more than 40 years now. And in the 80s, my husband John, who's taking photos in the back there, and I, we ended up working in Bhutan as well, which more of you will be familiar with Bhutan. Very similar situation in Bhutan. From those experiences, I ended up studying what was happening in other cultures. I wrote a book called Ancient Futures, which is about the contrast between that traditional culture and what happened with the advent of the modern global consumer culture. And we also made a film by the same name. And between the book and the film, they ended up translated into almost 50 languages. But they included things like Burmese translating the book and smuggling it into Burma about 20 years ago. They included, you know, people in Mongolia, in Laos, in South America. And from all around the world, I kept getting the message, the story you tell is our story too. So that was an empowerment that means that I've been going around the world for more than 40 years now, basically saying we must localize economic activity. We must insist that every bank, every business belongs to a place, is localized, so that society determines the rules of business rather than business shaping our culture, our identity, our politics. This is a process. It's not an absolute. What is local? Does it mean that, you know, everything we eat should come from 1 mile away or 100 miles away? It's not an absolute, but there is an absolute need to move away from a global economy where global businesses, using the global media and globally funded science and academia, global Western education, which trains the young for essentially non-existent jobs in fossil fuel-powered urban centers. It's a recipe for mass unemployment, mass destruction of identity, and at the same time, mass destruction of livelihoods. And when you rob people of the right to self-respect and the right to a livelihood, it's a recipe for racism, fundamentalism, terrorism, violence of every kind. For us, what is so incredibly inspiring is to see that everywhere in the world, there is another development, and it's from the bottom up, it's community-based, it's rebuilding the fabric of local economies, local communities, and ecological health. It's reducing energy consumption, and above all, the local food movement is at the center of this. We have a global local food movement that is incredibly inspiring, and that is such a hopeful demonstration that our problem is not human nature, is not innate human greed. Our problem is simply an outdated, stupid, blind idea about free trade. And people are intuitively turning against that, and they're turning for life, for connection, for that rebuilding of the deep social interdependence in intergenerational community and connection to nature. That's how we evolved. It's happening, and we hope that this conference will help to strengthen that movement. And we believe that it will be strengthened by more international exchange and information about all the wonderful things that are happening. Thank you.
Thank you, Helena. That was Helena Norberg Hodge. Ancient Futures. I'd like to call on Richard next. Richard Heinberg is one of the founders of the Transition Movement and the Post-Carbon Institute. And many of you may also know that he lives in Santa Rosa, which was just the site of those horrific fires. So maybe there's some specific information he has to bring us about resilience that he can share here tonight as well.
Right. Well, whether ironically or otherwise, my organization, Post-Carbon Institute, has been working for the last number of years on the mission of enhancing community resilience. And of course, this idea of community resilience was very much put to the test in the Santa Rosa fires. And we discovered, my wife Janet and I, who's here tonight, we live just a couple of miles from the devastation of the Tubbs Lane fire, which you probably saw in the news. We learned firsthand just how vulnerable actually we all are, whether to fire or to other forms of disaster, some of which are periodic and time immemorial, like earthquakes and so on, and some of which are the direct result of human activity, i.e. climate change. So knowing that we are vulnerable, what's the proper response? Well, we believe that it is building community resilience. What's that? Well, it has a lot to do with localization, in fact, because one of our greatest vulnerabilities in the modern world is the fact that we've built very long-distance supply chains based upon non-renewable, depleting, climate-changing fossil fuels. And these supply chains are brittle. They are based on extractive industries that are themselves not sustainable. So how do we build more resilience in the face of these kinds of challenges, climate change, the need for an energy transition away from fossil fuels, an economic system that's inherently fragile, and increasing economic inequality around the world that's causing more and more social distress and tension? Well, it's by building communities that are inherently more interconnected, where local food is at the heart of the process of the economy. One of the aspects of our work that has gotten probably the most attention over the last few years is our work on energy. And so I want to say a few words about one of our most recent projects, which is a book which you can look at free online, called Our Renewable Future. And this was a year-long project in which we decided, well, what will the energy transition look like? We know there has to be an energy transition, first of all, because fossil fuels are causing climate change, but also because fossil fuels are non-renewable and depleting. I mean, what we have done as a society is to base our entire economy on the ever-increasing rate of extraction and burning of resources that are inherently limited and depleting. That's the very definition of stupid. So you know that can't go on forever. My co-author on the project is David Fridley, who's in the energy analysis team at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, and we also had a dozen other experts working with us, each on a different subject area, food system, public health, so on, looking at how the transition could happen in each of those areas, what would be some of the roadblocks, some of the opportunities, and so on. And what we found is that it's not going to be a simple plug-and-play process of just unplugging the coal power plant, plugging in a solar panel, and continuing to live as we are now. There are two big roadblocks to that happening. One is the nature of the energy sources themselves. Intermittent renewable sources of energy are inherently different from fossil fuels, and we've built our current energy system around the unique strengths of fossil fuels. So to deal with the intermittency of solar and wind, we have to have some combination of energy storage, source redundancy, just building more capacity than we actually need at any one time, and demand adaptation, using energy when it's available rather than expecting it to be available 24/7. Each of these has a cost, either a behavioral cost or an investment cost. When we looked at the implications of these costs, our conclusion was it's very unlikely that we'll be able to have an energy system that supplies anything like the amount and reliability of energy that we currently take for granted. There are some big challenges, such as shipping and aviation. There's really no easy path toward electrification of shipping or aviation, or doing those with renewable energy in some other way. There are pathways, yes, but they're going to be expensive, and they're going to take a lot of time and engineering to roll out. So realistically, we're looking at a future of less transport, not just of people, but of stuff, and 9/10 of the stuff that gets transported is not people. It's food, building materials, raw materials, finished products, and so on. So we're looking at the end of globalization, one way or another. And how we prepare for that will make a great deal of difference to ourselves and certainly our children and grandchildren. We should be preparing for a localized future. But interestingly enough, that's what we should be doing anyway in order to have more resilient communities. So it's sort of like, you know, all paths are leading to the same conclusion. Whether you think the future is going to be a sort of dystopian nightmare and we need to prepare for it by banding together, or you think that the future is going to be a, you know, utopian world of renewable energy, either way, realistically, what we need to do is move away from the globalized model of economic interaction and move back toward a much more local and interconnected way of living.
Thank you very much, Richard. I've had the privilege of working with David Corton for nearly 20 years. We founded Yes Magazine together, and it's just a delight to be on the stage with you, David.
By way of introduction, I'm David Corton. I grew up down in Longview, Washington, which many of you, I'm sure, know, Lumbertown. By a strange course, I decided that when I was growing up, we viewed America as a leader of the world, the model of a middle-class democracy, that we had a model to take to the world. And I ended up deciding that that was how I was going to spend my life. And I came at it with the belief that bringing the secrets of American business success to the rest of the world would be the key to their salvation, so they could become fat, happy consumers like us, and particularly at that point, give up this communist revolution nonsense. So that was my life passion. So I went to Stanford Business School and ended up on the Harvard Business School faculty. Went with my wife, Fran. We went to Ethiopia, set up a business school in Haile Selassie University. We lived for years in Nicaragua, Central America, and then another, ultimately 10 years in the Philippines and 5 years in Indonesia. And one of the things that we began to recognize over time was exactly what Helena described to us. That in many ways, in many of the traditional communities, before we outsiders brought in development and modernization, people really had better, more beautiful lives than they had after development came in. And I do recall that the economists were very clear that to develop these folks, we've got to get them off the land. Essentially, we had to separate them from the sources of their food and their water, their ability to be independent, and get them dependent on the wages working for Western corporations in factories and so forth, producing goods for export. We began to, over time, to realize that this really was a disaster. In about 1991, I was visiting a friend of mine in India, Indian intellectual named Smitu Katari. And Smitu said, "David, we know you and Fran came over here to help us. We appreciate that. But we think you're just beginning to understand what our real problem is. So if you really want to help us, go home and teach your own people what you have learned here." That's what we did. And that's what led me to write When Corporations Rule the World, which is what I'm still best known for. Now, the thing that I've found increasingly at the front of my awareness is what in the Club of Rome we call, we're beginning to call, the existential crisis of humanity. That's the thing that I don't have to tell you that I'm sure is in the back of every mind here. That we are, in fact, pushing ourselves in the direction of conscious, aware, human self-extinction. It is a moment in which we have to fundamentally rethink and reinvent ourselves in the deepest ways in terms of coming to grips with what it means to be living beings born of and nurtured by a living earth. Nothing radical about that. It's pretty simple, straightforward, something we all know, something certainly that our indigenous brothers and sisters know very well. And yet everything we do in terms of how we organize is contrary to that basic truth. And our economy is organized not around what do we need to be fully functioning, healthy, happy human beings, but rather how do we make more money? By latest count, we humans are consuming at 1.7 times what Earth can sustain. Clearly unsustainable. Second statistic, 8 individual humans now have financial assets equal to the total financial assets of half of humanity. I don't know what that's, something like 3.6, 3.7 billion people compared to 8. Thank you.
Thank you, David. So that's sort of a dire way to start out our conversation. So I want to just bring in one other factor here, which is the factor of happiness, because this is an economics of happiness conversation.
With highlights from the Economics of Happiness Conference keynote panel featuring Helena Norberg Hodge, David Corton, Richard Heinberg, and Sarah Van Gelder, this is Steve Evans reporting for KPTZ Compass. This week's KPTZ Compass was written and produced by Steve Evans. You can listen to podcasts of past Compass programs at the kptz.org website, where you can also stream KPTZ live 24 hours a day. In addition, KPTZ Compass recorded all of the plenary session presentations at the Economics of Happiness Conference and is making them available under the KPTZ specials in the podcast area of our website. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.